Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello, everybody. It is I, Alejandro Rojas, your host for UFO Think Tank Radio. I can't help but, you know, at the beginning of that, maybe I'll do it next time. I'll unmute myself and go, You know, it's got that kind of funky, thing going on there. And it's not that I meant to get some, you know, hip-hoppy type of thing. I like how it has that kind of that sci-fi, but it's kind of a cool Urban Sowski. He will be our host tonight, or our guest. I'm the host. He better not try to take over the show. He's actually a good buddy of mine, a MUFON investigator out of Colorado Springs, which is just south of here, home of Cheyenne Mountain, which is home of NORAD, which is the home of U.S. Space Command. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, if you are not aware, there is such a thing as Space Command. It is not just in Stargate. And speaking of Stargate, Chuck was actually with me a couple of weekends ago at the sci-fi convention where we did, or I did a talk, and we handed out material and gave out information. That's always a lot of fun. And maybe I'll see if I could get him to tell us about how he reacted when he met Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica, who looks very attractive on television and looks even more so in person. She's a cutie. But Chuck, actually, speaking of sci-fi again, this all kind of rolls into itself, was on the Sci-Fi Channel as part of their Roswell Diggs show. So you might have seen that a few years ago where Brian Gumbel hosted two or three episodes of Roswell Diggs where University of New Mexico geologist Bill Dolman took people out to go to the crash site and actually look for material, and we'll talk about that somewhat in just a little bit here. So, and it looks like in the chat room, if you're joining us, we've got our fun skeptic, Mr. Pastor Pat, or at least that's what he calls himself. He's a funny guy, so if you're in the chat, you know, say hello to the pastor. He's definitely, I don't know if you call him a skeptic or just kind of a, he's not a very nice guy for being a pastor. He says some mean stuff, but he's a lot of fun to converse with. Anyway, let's get into UFO news for the week. So for the past couple weeks, actually, not a whole lot of news, not as much as usual. Of course, you know, people are surprised to know that there's any UFO news in mainstream media in a weekly period, but there's typically a lot. So when I say there's not much, there's only two or three that I could see, you know, a week, as opposed to sometimes dozens. So there's a lot going on. First, let's see. Moscow. I posted a couple stories from All News Web where people have filmed or taken pictures of UFOs above Moscow, and there's some interesting films. So you can go to the, remember, you can go to UFOthinkTank.com scroll toward the bottom and you'll see all of these stories. Or if you're at the Blog Talk site, on the right-hand side, you'll see the Yahoo group email list for UFO Think Tank, and you can go look at these. Also, let's see, Arizona having more sightings. This came from the UFO Examiner from examiner.com. And as you all know, I am now the Denver Paranormal Science Examiner. And I posted a story on physicist Michio Kaku. I don't think I told you all that. I can't remember if I mentioned how I went to go see Michio Kaku, who's a renowned theoretical physicist. In fact, he is credited with coming up with the string theory, and I think we've all heard of that. And I'm not quite sure how to technically explain it, but essentially it has to do with a lot of dimensions, multi-dimensions, and somehow these dimensions are related, and he talks about these bubbles of reality that we can pop in and out of or might one day be able to do in a universe, being in a bubble in a field, or he's mentioning something about that way over my head. And I like to think that I am somewhat okay with science, you know. I'm at least able to roll a little bit with Claude Swanson, the physicist we had on the show. This stuff's way over my head. But what is cool is this pretty much turned out to be a paranormal talk. His book is called The Physics of the Impossible. You got to check it out. He talks about moving faster than the speed of light. He talks about extraterrestrial civilizations and where we would fit among technology when it comes to lots of different extraterrestrial technologies. He even relates that to Star Trek. I'm sure many of you are actually out watching Star Trek and you're not listening live, but I'm going to actually go see it on Sunday. I hear it's great, by the way. I had a buddy at work who went during his lunch hour, took a long lunch, and he came back just all excited. Just like Pastor Pat, it looks like he is a Star Trek fan too, making some comments in our chat room. Thank you, Mr. Pastor. But he talked about ESP, he talked about telekinesis, and one of the coolest things was is when I got up to the table, you know, I kind of felt actually like Chuck did when he got to meet Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica. I was a little Twitter-pated. This guy is pretty cool. In fact, if you go to the Discovery, or if you watch a lot of the documentaries on physics, you'll see him. In fact, he was on the ABC Primetime Special on UFOs that MUFON was also involved with. But when I got up to the table, I told him about how MUFON is putting together a scientific symposium. That's something that we're working on. We're talking with physicists. And the main issue we want to battle is the assumption by the SETI group, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, the guys with the big telescopes that are looking for radio signals. They say there's no way that there are extraterrestrial civilizations here because that's just too far to travel. And to me, that sounds kind of silly because, of course, just going across the ocean, some people used to think was too far to travel, but they were proved wrong. And unfortunately for the SETI people, I think they've kind of are going to relegate themselves as the foolish when it comes to history, because there's no doubt, you know, with the advancement of science, we're going to do things that we couldn't even imagine. So when I mentioned that to Michio Kaku and SETI, he said, you know what, I'm no friend of SETI. He said, they're a bunch of astronomers, so what do they know about physics? Totally. That's what I've been saying the whole time. Amen, brother. So that was really cool. That was a great event. He did a book signing in Denver at the Tattered Cupboard. So, and there's also a bunch of other sighting stories that you can see from examiner.com. I don't have the details in front of me right now, but, you know, at MUFON.com, you can always go to the CMS and see all of the sightings that are reported, and there are a lot of them. We get hundreds of reports a month. All of them are posted on the site. You see it real time. As soon as the witness pushes click, through the magic of the internet and at the speed of light, thanks to fiber optics, you're able to see those immediately. In fact, there's a really cool map on MUFON.com, and you can, it's using Google, but you could keep this on your desktop, and you'll either get a little UFO or a little alien head popping up periodically somewhere on the map of the United States. The UFO is when someone submits a report. The alien head is when someone reports seeing an entity, which happens, of course, not often. And then you can highlight that icon and get more details about the report. Remember, these are the raw reports, so this is prior to investigations being done. To get the results of those investigations, you can hire the or go be a subscriber to MUFON and get the journal where we post some of those findings, or you could listen to this show where we post and talk about those findings, or you can also go to the UFO Examiner on examiner.com, and he also posts some of that information. And in fact, you find MUFON stories all over the Internet. So it's really cool stuff. You know, nothing being hidden there. It's just immediately there for your perusal. Speaking of MUFON investigators, it looks like I have one of my favorite on the line, Mr. Chuck Sutkowski. Let's see if we can get him rolling here. You there, Chuck?
I'm here. Am I here?
Good. You're here.
I think
you're here. Are you good?
I think so.
I can hear you loud and clear.
10-4.
So doing good.
Doing good. Working on my presentation for tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. Chuck is going to be part of the Colorado UFO briefing, something I put together on a yearly basis where we bring a lot of investigators to talk about UFOs. And Chuck is going to be one of those people. And
yeah.
Just, I guess, to start off, one thing I would like to mention, or, you know, going into your past, one thing you do is you work closely with your sister. I'm pretty close with my sisters, too. But that's kind of cool. How did that come about?
Well, how close do you want to say close? Pretty close, but we don't share the same bed, if that's what you mean.
Oh, I didn't mean that at all.
No, you know, there's 6 kids in our family, and I have 2 younger brothers and 3 older sisters, and she's the second oldest sister, or the second one that was born. And basically about 12 years ago, we were at a family reunion in California. She lives in Missouri, and she's the state director for MUFON. And, of course, I'm over here in Colorado. We met at a family reunion, and we just were just talking about UFOs, just happened to pop up, and it turns out that she was investigating some of the things I was investigating. And I knew she was interested in it, but I didn't know that she was really seriously investigating. So we decided to go ahead and combine forces. And our first project was really Roswell, among some other things that were happening here in Colorado and Missouri.
And when did you start doing that?
Roswell, 1999-2000 is when we combined forces.
Mm-hmm.
We had talked on and off before that, but, you know, really we decided, you know, we could do a little bit better if we go, you know, we went ahead and did, you know, did the work together, we could tackle it, you know, 200% instead of 100% type of thing. And really, Roswell, since we decided we were going to be down there anyway, we went ahead and decided we're going to tackle that first in 99 and 2000. And I already had some connections down there, but it was kind of nice having my sister there because, you know, Walter Haught and Glenn Dennis and them, you know, they always like to hang around the girls. So that was an easy in.
Yeah, that's one thing. In this field, there's not a lot of, a whole lot of women researching. So sometimes the guys get a little excited.
Yeah, especially the ones that are, you know, 20 years older. But, Glenn Dennis was just he still is, you know, he's just a pleasure and such a neat man. And, you know, back in 99, I think it was either 99 or 2000, you know, he had seen me there enough times to, you know, to know me and recognize me and just talk to me. And he took me into his office and originally gave me the GPS coordinates for, you know, what he considered was the debris site. And that's where we started really actively investigating, doing field investigation, at least in Roswell. And I think we pretty much started in 2000, even though we got the information in 99.
You're a little quiet. I wonder if it would be possible to talk closer to the phone or a little louder. There you
go.
So maybe, too, for the audience, you can explain who Glenn Dennis was.
Oh, Glenn Dennis was the young mortician down in Ballard Funeral Home in Roswell back in 1947. And he's the one that the military had called and asked him if he knew where to get some child-sized coffins, caskets, if you will. And he was just kind of wondering. He didn't have any, but he was wondering, well, you know, why would they need child-sized caskets? And anyway, that's pretty much how he got started in the Roswell incident. And then it kind of escalated from there.
Mm-hmm. And did you find him to be pretty credible?
He's a pretty cool guy. We found a lot of, you know, originally when I started talking to him, I would do normally what I don't do it on purpose, but a lot of times I'll reiterate questions, a year later. And I get the same answers. So, I mean, if he wasn't telling the truth to me, he was pretty good at it because he was giving me the same information over and over again. And we pretty much thought that, you know, he was right on and very truthful and a very honest man.
Now, when people go down to Roswell, they're able to take a tour of the crash site. And that's not the same place that Glenn Dennis gave you, correct?
Yeah, correct. Actually, as you come into Roswell from the main highway, you'll see off to the right a little flying saucer, and it says crash site. And that's we call that the Hubcorn site. No, it's not the real debris site. Now, we don't know for a fact whether or not it's a real diversionary site. It could very well be a diversionary site back in the late 40s, where, you know, it was misinformation or disinformation, I should say, to point people to another site. I hear a couple of different stories. One is that story that, you know, it was a diversionary site. The second story is, you know, whoever previously owned the land, not the people now, but whoever previously owned it, for some reason or other said, you know, it happened there and pretty much started that myth into somewhat of a reality for some of the people who pay $50 or $60 a pop. As a matter of fact, I think it was even $90 last year. I think someone was paying
to
go down there in a bus ride. And they weren't very happy when they came back and were all excited and telling us that they saw what the crash site. We said, oh, no, you didn't. Not too many people go out to the actual debris site. It's kind of well hidden, and only a few of us have the GPS coordinates for that.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a few alleged sites, right?
Yeah, really, there are. You have the debris site. The debris site, if anybody is familiar with the Roswell incident, what Mac Brazel saw, the debris that he saw along with his son Vern, was actually what we call the skip site. And that's where a craft had came down. It's sort of like taking a Frisbee and hitting a Frisbee on the ground and watching it skip off the cement or skipping a rock on a lake. You know, you had that one initial skip. And so it came down, skipped there, left a lot of debris, and then kind of shot off before it impacted. And so that's number one site. There's a number two site where allegedly, while it was still in the air in between the first and second impact, that some material debris had fallen out along with a couple of bodies. And so that's site two. Site three is where the craft came down. Now, there's other rumors, too. I shouldn't say rumors. I mean, they're just basically stories that we're trying to evaluate and try and get the truth behind of what really happened. But it almost looks like maybe a couple of craft had impacted, and one went down near the plains of St. Augustine, and one went down in Roswell. And we don't know whether or not the craft broke up or there were maybe escape pods or something like that, because we also have the Jim Ragsdale site, which is still a pretty cool site. Some people, I know Stanton Freeman, says basically it's not a real site. There are some people there in Corona that have a tendency to believe that it is a site where something happened. And then we have a new site that we were looking at, which is on the other side of the El Capitan Mountains, or basically on the other side of the Jim Ragsdale side. And then the UFO Museum, the International UFO Museum and Research Center, they're also working on another site that I think it's like 40 miles outside of Roswell, and that's a good site too. That's probably out of all of them except for the debris site, that's probably the second most believable site, the one that Don Schmidt and Tom Curry and the International UFO Museum is working on.
So Glenn Dennis gave you a debris site.
Yeah, what he did was he gave me the GPS coordinates for the BLM marker, and how convenient that our buddies in the government, the Bureau of Land Management, had put a marker out there, you know, sometime in the, I don't know, must have been in the early 40s or maybe even before that. And really, the marker was really only a couple of hundred yards away from where Mac Brazel had said the debris was scattered. And we went out to that marker, and we found the marker really before we found the roads. We kind of just 4x4'd out there. And kind of remembering what we read and some of the people we talked to, we had an idea of the terrain and what the terrain might look like. So we passed the marker. And seriously, Alejandro, this is pretty cool. We were probably within, 50, 75 yards of the actual debris site that we did an archaeology dig back in 2002. We were that close. And it doesn't really matter because, really, if something came down and impacted, it would have scattered debris all over the place. It probably, some people say quarter mile, eighth of a mile. Some people say 300 yards. So we were in the debris field back in 2000, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Just not maybe right where supposedly Mac Brazel said the gouge was, but, we were in the right area. And we had metal detectors out there. We were doing all kinds of goofy things. And that was back in 2000.
Yeah, so how did you hook up with Sci-Fi Channel?
Well, every year since then, I kind of started off I probably started off in the early 90s researching Roswell just because, just like one of your listeners right now, you listen to radio talk shows or you go to symposiums or you go to like Colorado UFO briefings and you're out in the audience and you're going, that's pretty cool. I could do that and I might be able to do something a little bit differently than the person is talking about right now. We all don't think the same. We all think differently, and thank goodness for that, because if we all thought the same, we wouldn't be as far as we are now. So, it's because of all that creativity we have. So now, I was in the audience, and Roswell always fascinated me, and I had made a decision that, I'm going to take a run out there. And at the time I went out there was three museums. There was the International UFO Museum, and I apologize, I can't remember the name of the other two. There was one actually closer to the Roswell Army Air Force Base, and then there was one a few miles away from that. The other one, I just drew a blank. It's where a lot of the Roswell Rod videos came out of, and basically that was out of his garage. And I would truck the family there during, we would have a vacation. We'd take off in the family truckster, and we'd swing by Roswell. My poor family, or we'd swing by Sedona or Dulce or Taos, any place that there was UFO activity, we'd swing by, and that'd be part of my field work, tell the family, go do something for a while. I'm gonna be investigating this.
How would the kids take it? Would they roll their eyes, or did they get excited about it?
They still roll their eyes. My youngest is 19, and I have 23, 25-year-old, 20, he's going to be 26, and, both my boys have been in Iraq already, one last year and the other one 3 years ago, and the one that was there 3 years ago, he's headed back probably to Afghanistan later on this year. But, and I just say that just to kind of give you an idea of the type of, kids I have. They're good kids, but, Dad, come on, Matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago when I was in the local papers over here on the cattle mutilation cases and then also the rock face from Ute Park, somebody brought the newspaper into where my son works, and he works, he's a security guard in the emergency room over at North Memorial Hospital over here, and they're kind of harassing him. This is your dad? Yeah, they get it all the time. Even now they get it.
Yeah. So we were getting to how you hooked up with sci-fi.
Oh, I apologize. Okay.
No, no, that's okay.
I'm glad you got this stuff written down because I just kind of take off. I'm in my office right now. I got a new office, which is totally cool. It used to be one of my kids' bedrooms, and then when they moved out, turned it into an office, so I have all my Star Trek stuff.
Imagine what it looks like.
One of these days you're going to have to come in and check it out. Definitely, because I have one of my pictures up here of my favorite Starbucks.
It is funny because we always meet in the field on investigations or at conferences or something.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Mm-hmm. So 1 year we were Debbie and I were in 2000, or I think it was 2001. I think because we went out to the site in 2000, 2001 we were there, and I think if it was 2002 we were back again doing some more investigations. By that time we were investigating not only the debris site but the Jim Ragsdale site and looking for impact sites. And Don Schmidt over at the UFO and Roswell investigator had seen us there a few times, and he was looking for volunteers to help with an archaeology dig. And it was kind of really bizarre because in 2000 we were at the site and we were already talking about doing an archaeology dig, and that's why we were there in 2002. Was we were actually looking at the site, and we were doing the research behind the BLM and seeing what it takes to take a crew out there, volunteer crew. And as it happens, here they were already planning something. Sci-Fi Channel was funding it, and so he asked us if we would be part of the volunteer team. And really, out of the volunteer team that was there, we were the only two UFO investigators. First, and secondly, the only two that knew anything about Roswell. The rest were just people, different walks of life. Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, of course, were there, but they didn't actually participate in the dig themselves. They were just there doing other things for the show. So we did all the grunt work.
You were the grunt? You are
we
kind
were
of,
the grunt. If,
yeah. I think you are kind of falling off a little bit there on volume, just
sorry.
So you're aware.
Oh, sorry.
So cool.
Sorry.
That's kind of fun.
I was being sincere, Towards the end of the conversation, I was being a little sincere,
Getting a little nostalgic.
Getting a little nostalgic, looking at my Klingon sisters here, big cardboard copy or cut out of them. And,
about
next
being
time you're in the area,
desert.
You're going to have to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's
so
how
you
we
guys
got involved in Roswell.
The digging.
What's that?
So was Bryant, who was there with you doing the dig? And just the volunteers, was Bryant Gumbel there at all?
Oh, no. Like most people, they show up afterwards. They really don't do any celebrity-wise, no one's there. Really, the only celebrity that we got to work with us for a little bit was Boston Rob from Survivor, and that was in the 2006 dig. And I actually, was teaching them how to do I think it was a 4-meter by 4-meter strip dig. And he was having a good time with it. And then, of course, Rich Dolan was there at the time, too. So we were showing Rich how to do archaeology, UFO archaeology work. But really, in 2002, Bryant Gumbel came in after the fact. After the main shots were taken, they brought him in, I would imagine, a couple of weeks after we had left for the what we call the money shots.
And so did you ended up, how many shows were there, first of all, sir?
Well, really, there was two. The first one, Debbie and I were the proverbial Bigfoot in the background scenes, And if you watch it, you'll catch us in the background here or there because really, the show was about Roswell and archaeology was one of their fillers. And we were serious. There were some people that wanted to get in front of the camera, and my sister and I were more interested in finding something. This is something that we were personally working on for 2 years that we wanted to be out there. And so while some of the other volunteers were trying to get camera shots, and which they did, you know, they made it a point to do that. My sister and I would take off, and we would, you know, we'd be on our own dig, and we'd concentrate, and we'd blow off, you know, lunch, catered lunch, and some other things to sit there and see if we could find, you know, something that that resembled what Mac Brazel and Jesse Marcel Jr. had seen. And as it turns out, we did, because of our, you know, our motivation and the drive. While everybody left after, you know, I think it was 4 days or so, the fifth day, Debbie rescheduled her plane flight, and we came back on the fifth day. Only a couple of volunteers were there, basically just, you know, to get in background scenes for the camera shots. And we started doing the strip dig, and out of the strip dig, that yielded the most artifacts out of the whole 4 days, I guess 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and, you know, you think
really
you found a couple interesting things, huh?
Yeah, we did. And it is way cool. And that's something I'm going to be discussing tomorrow at the Colorado UFO, the infamous Colorado UFO briefing. But the most important thing, and really you can see a picture of it on my website, ufonut.com. If you'll see a couple pictures in the beginning of the webpage, and one will say 2002 dig, and click into that, and you'll see, you know, Humuo or artifact found. And really it's the only thing that we found at first that we thought, well, man, this really resembles, you know, that type of material. And we didn't know whether or not we could shoot pictures of it, because we thought maybe we might be under contract. But so Debbie snuck her camera out, shot a couple of pictures. And as it turns out, it was no big deal. We could have shot as many pictures as we wanted. But we really didn't know what was going on back then, because it's really the first time we were involved in anything like that with, you know, a production studio. So we we had the only pictures of any artifact that came out of it. And as it turns out, it probably falls within the top three out of all the artifacts that were found.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why this falls into the top three is because it's metallic-looking, and it resembles what they saw back in 47. Does it resemble the memory, what do they call it, memory paper or memory metal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know. Because I've never seen a piece of memory metal, so I don't know. Will it unfold by itself? No. You know, basically, it was triangular to start off with. When it hit the sun, all three edges curled up. And then when we bagged it later on, a few months later, when one of the archaeologists pulled out to have a, not a few months, but a couple weeks later when they did a visual analysis, it was flat again and curled up. Now, that could be because of the most obvious might be because of saturation with just condensation. You know, if it's moist, you know, and, you know, you get a little bit of water in it. Now, you got to remember this little piece is probably the size of your fingernail. But a little bit longer, maybe about an inch long and about a quarter inch or so wide. And so it curled up either due to moisture, and then the moisture evaporated all of a sudden because you put it out, you know, in direct sunlight. It could have curled because of, direct sunlight heat or plasma
mm-hmm.
energy. You know, we don't know. But I had it analyzed, I'll be discussing it tomorrow anyway. But, you know, when I had it analyzed last year and this year, the preliminary analyzation, because <there's> I don't know if it's a real word or not. Anyway, it turns out that it's aluminum silicon, and we found it under 8 centimeters worth of dirt, which is roughly around 6 inches underground. And that's what's kind of interesting. Strip digging. What you basically do is you strip you have a person working a big sifting device, and you strip away the very top vegetation, and you kind of sift through that, and then you go down, you know, 2 to 4 centimeters, you know, which is only a couple of inches or an inch, you know, and then you sift that, and then you go down a little further, and we were guessing based on the experience of Dr. Dillman, that anything within about 8 to 10 centimeters due to the erosion rate of that particular area of desert in New Mexico that it would put us back into, he was guessing around the 40s, you know. But you know, it's an educated guess, and you really don't know for a fact because, you know, unfortunately we really don't have a timeline clock that kind of is embedded in the ground that tells us exactly. And really, radiocarbon dating, you know, that's too only 40, 50 years. You know, that's not good enough. You have to go back thousands of years for carbon dating to really be
efficient. Well, and talking about those Roswell dig shows, there are people, because the show, the last one, made a big deal that, look, we found stuff, and we're going to get this analyzed, and that's going to be in the next exciting episode, and then the next exciting episode never showed up. And that's what's exciting, is that you guys are finally taking this stuff out and trying to get it looked at.
We, once again, and this is for your listeners out there, you know, once again, you have people in the audience that go, you know what, I can do that, or I'll take the bull by the horns and I'll take the responsibility to do that. And that's what we did, even though we're investigators. What we decided to do is, you know, 2008 rolled around. We've been talking about trying to get a hold of this thing. We got a hold of a part of a bridle, a horse's bridle that was found in 2006 that I think I talked about last year. And I went through the paperwork through UNM, archaeology department, in the proverbial warehouse of stored artifacts where Indiana Jones keeps his hat, you know. And it really was. There was a lot of paperwork to get the permission to borrow, you know, a BLM artifact from the university. And, you know, I started with the horse's bridle, and we knew it was a horse's bridle. There was no doubt. But what we were doing was an analysis of the dirt on the horse's bridle and to find out why the horse's bridle was broken. Because the horse's bridle, if you watched the 2006 show, that was Sci-Fi Investigates Roswell. And that's when the Boston Rob was on with Dr. Dolman, Rich Dolan, and I think Deborah, Lisa to start with, and Deborah towards the end. We found this broken bridle right there at the debris site, and I looked at it, and of course, you know, they bagged it, put it into the camera, and it was kind of gone. And it kind of sat that way for a little while, and a couple years ago, you know, because it happened in 2006, and I think it was 2007, Christmas time sometime around there, and I just wake up in the middle of the night going, I'm an idiot, man. We need to get a hold of that bridle. We need to find out first why it broke. What did it break just because, you know, it was worn, or did it break due to the horse rearing up? And the reason why that's important is because a couple of years after the debris had scattered in that area, eyewitnesses state that no animal would travel across the area where the debris used to be after the military cleaned it up. And we had talked with Fawn Fritz, who was a granddaughter of the Brazels, and, you know, she stated that Grandpa would, you know, they had to herd the sheep a quarter mile around the debris field to get it to the water. If you've ever been out there, you'd understand why, because the pasture's on one side, the debris field's in the middle, the water well, the windmill's on the other side. And they even tried to bait, put hay and put some type of feed across it so the sheep would go through, and they wouldn't. And so much so that even the horses wouldn't, and the horses would rear up. And so that's why I thought, oh, man, that bridle's kind of cool. I want to find out whether or not a horse reared up and snapped it. And it did. The bridle the bridle was definitely snapped. It was a very clean break, and it wasn't a worn break. And we looked at under that, you know, under microscopic analysis to get in there to really look to see how the metal, and of course, you know, it was identifiable. We knew what it was. But what was interesting.
So once you got the bridle, you were thinking, well, if I could get this, maybe I could get the other stuff to look at.
Oh, right, right. And the neat thing about the bridle is the bridle had traces of titanium dirt or dust. I shouldn't say dirt, titanium particles. And that was kind of cool, too. And then so now you have two different investigations. We have one where the bridle looks like, okay, you know, something happened here to cause the horse to rear up or break the bridle. And then all of a sudden we've got titanium deposits on the bridle. And so now you have to try and understand, is titanium indigenous to that area? And yes and no, but then you're absolutely right. So what we did was, you know, we had the initial paperwork done for the bridle, so I kind of had the idea. So if you do a freedom, I was what?
Hello?
Hello, am I there?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know. Audrey came in and said something. yeah, and actually, it was kind of interesting, too, because it was an English voice. So anyway...
When?
What's that?
You just heard an English voice?
You didn't hear it?
No.
Oh, I swear. It said something, you were on the queue or you're just off the queue or something, and it was an English voice, a woman's voice.
Oh, that's the radio program.
Yeah. And I said, yeah, Audrey just came in. And if anybody knows anything about Stan Romanek, they'll know what we're talking about.
Yeah, they'll have to come to the briefing tomorrow.
That's right. If you want
to
learn about Audrey, you've got to come to the briefing tomorrow. It's only a $5 donation. Be there or be rectangular. So we knew we were in the right area, and they had entrusted me with the with the bridle. So I went ahead and submitted the paperwork for the little metallic piece that we didn't know at the time it was metallic. To be honest with you, Debbie was the only one that held it. My sister Debbie, and she says, "Oh no, it was definitely felt metal to me, but it's very 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 light because the breeze was trying to blow it out of my hand." And I was thinking it could have been organic, it could have been, a piece of a wing or something. But so when we got a hold of it and looked at it, we go, clearly this thing is metallic. And then placed under electron scanning microscope, and we're getting down at 50 microns, which is 1/1000th of a mil or millimeter or whatever. Or is it a meter?
Real tiny.
Real tiny. Actually, 1 × 10⁻⁹, I think is what it is. And we saw, oh my gosh, look at this, electron scanning microscope basically bombards the metal or whatever it's bombarding with electrons and kind of, let me see, micron, micrometer, unit of length, metric system, 1/1000th of a meter, okay. So anyway, you're kind of bombarding this material with electrons and basically it's reflecting what the surface of the material is made out of. And now we're looking at it going, whoa, look at this. It's coming back aluminum with silicon embedded in it.
Which is kind of interesting because I've heard a lot of people who have had what they believe to be and have been purported to be pieces of spacecraft from witnesses who have seen things falling off of them or seen one land, and they get a piece of material or even a alleged crashes, a lot of this material comes back to be a very pure aluminum or aluminum silicate.
Yeah, exactly. The Bob White object. I have a piece of that that was aluminum. And then supposedly I think some of the debris from the plains of St. Augustine that
and the Aurora, Texas. They found metal from that they think might have been from the Aurora, Texas crash in the, 1880s.
Uh-huh.
And that came out to be aluminum. And I know there's at least a few others that are like
And what's pretty cool about that for your listeners, too, is aluminum is one of the most abundant minerals along with silicon on a planet. And basically that means... Does it mean, it was made here? Not necessarily because, especially when you're looking at UFO artifacts, basically any meteorite that it has impacted on this planet so far to record, the minerals in the meteorite have fallen somewhere on the periodic table. We haven't found one yet that goes, like Andromeda Strain, the movie Andromeda Strain or something, where you get something that's unrecognizable. So basically what it's turning out, at least this section of our galaxy, is all the planets seem to be made of the same type of minerals, or we're familiar with all the same type of minerals. So when you find a UFO, what you think is a UFO hard artifact, if we're not looking at to see whether or not it's a new metal. The metal should be recognizable. We're going to see, first off, the technology used to make that piece, and then also we look at the isotopes. And isotope analysis is something that's a little expensive and a little bit out of my my range for investments. The electron scanning microscope analysis, I've had it done twice, and they usually run about $300, $400 per 3.5 hour, session. So, right there, you're close to $600-$700 just to have two lab analyses done, the same one.
And that's what you're hoping to do now with the isotope test.
Yeah, right? you get a little closer, and you want to look at the isotopes. You want to see, we have an idea of what the isotope structure would be for, known metals on this planet. And so now we want to see, whether or not they fall within, that realm. Another thing you want to look at, too, is, if it is a aluminum silicon alloy, does that resemble other aluminum silicon alloys that we know of now? Now, no fair saying, oh, yeah, we have it now, here you go. Because, I found it. I dug it. My sister is the one that actually found it. We found it under, roughly 6 to 8 inches of, 6 inches of dirt or 8 centimeters of dirt. So we know it's been in the desert for a few years, no doubt. So someone would have to say, yeah, that resembles an alloy that was made in the 30s or was made in the 40s here in the U.S. But they say, oh, yeah, it resembles an alloy that was made, in the 80s or the 90s. Then it just tells us, could the stuff that's being made now could have been reverse engineered. Out of stuff that fell down in the late 1800s or let's say in the 40s. So that's what
So hopefully you'll be able to get more work done on that. But moving on to some of your other cool Roswell discoveries. Also, actually, before we leave the sci-fi show thing, they were going to shoot more shows, and then that got that just didn't happen, right?
Yeah, that got thrown in the circular file, we like to say.
And didn't they give
you say something else? I'm sorry?
To preempt that, to get ready for the next shows, didn't they give you some equipment or something like that?
Well, basically, the Marshall
outfitted
trawls.
You?
Yeah, the Marshall trawls are really these little gardening tools, but they're actually archaeology trawls, and they were handed out to all to the volunteer archaeologists in 2002, and Debbie and I. We donated our trawls along with our gloves and our knee pads to the International UFO Museum, and they should still be on display there. When we went back in 2006, we got issued new trawls. But basically, that's the only equipment we kept. Everything else we bought on our own, the knee pads, the gloves, the small picks, the shovels, and stuff like that. Because like I said, we were planning on doing something similar to that anyway. And basically that's part of a UFO kit anyway. You need to have a field kit, and that's part of a field kit is you may need to take dirt samples, as with the cattle mutilations. So you have to have the materials there to be able to dig into the dirt and bag it and do all kinds of goofy things. But they had always considered doing more shows. And really there should have been a show to talk about the artifacts in 2002, what was found there. And that never happened, and basically it's like every big company, you may have, new managers come in, or maybe it's based on funding or whatever, but that never happened. And so in 2006, when the Sci-Fi Channel created a miniseries called Sci-Fi Investigates, and they were going back to Roswell because they thought that was pretty cool, and Dr. Dolman was on the team, and he wanted to go back there anyway because there was a couple of unanswered questions for him. He went ahead and called us up and says, hey, I'm going back to Roswell. Do you want to come and help us out? And we said, yeah. So, that's how we went back for 2006. And really, my sister and I were the only volunteers there. So basically, we were just part of the archaeology team. There was, I believe, two other archaeologists there in 2006, along with Dr. Dolman.
Cool. So then your next Roswell find, or you helped out with the investigation in the Roswell Rock Circle. So why don't you tell us about
that? Yeah, pretty interesting. Good old Robert. Interesting. What it is, how these things come to us is, and Alejandro can probably agree to this, is my sister and I, when we when we lecture, we sort of like lecture for free, you know, because this is a hobby. We really enjoy it. Of course, expenses are always welcomed, Roswell, Alejandro. But we basically, we like to get the information out to people. So one of the lectures we were doing, getting the information out, we had someone from the audience come up, a gentleman called Robert Ridge, and he says, you know, I found something back in, you know, in early 2000, and I'd like to show it to you. And the reason why they like to come to us and not to the International UFO Museum is, and because it's right there in Roswell, too, is because there's, I don't want to say there's a lot of controversy, but sometimes they look at the museum as a place where maybe things could be debunked, or maybe they're not, they won't be as open-minded or something, because it's a business, and we're not. You know, we don't have a book out. You know, we basically do this for you know, for fun as a hobby, and we love to share whatever information, you know, we've learned to the public. And he was pretty impressed with that, so much so that he came over and shared what he had found. And so that started the Roswell Rock Circle investigation. It's pretty cool, Rock. You can see it on my website, too, ufonut.com. And no, you won't find any PayPal donations and on that, you know. It's basically...
Yeah, why don't you explain the rock?
The rock's pretty cool. You know, it'll fit in the palm of your hand. It looks like a river rock. We're not too sure what it's made out of internally. It has had some scanning done, so you know we know generally what the makeup of is, and it's basically a standard rock. And then it has a crop circle. It's not really engraved on it. The crop circle kind of comes out of it three-dimensionally, and it's a crop circle that occurred in England back in, I believe, 96 or so. And what's interesting about that is, you know, when we first saw it, you know, I look at, well, yeah, anybody can engrave that. And the more you look at it, you're going, well, that's really cool. And the engraving, or the way that the circle comes out of the rock is really, really cool. And it didn't look, it was so precise, like it was laser cut. And it's a hard rock, you know, iron ore type. Well, you think it's iron ore, but it's kind of interesting. We really don't know what the internal makeup of the rock is. We're still trying to look into that field. And just very recently, as of last week, Dr. Dolman is still looking into trying to figure that out, into using three-dimensional scanning microscope or something or other, something that he just started reading about. Anyway... I mentioned Dr. Dolman because we were in Roswell at the time, and it was just after our lecture, and this gentleman came over and talked to us. And so at that time, this couple of years ago, we decided, you know, let's head over to Albuquerque where Dr. Dolman is, because by that time, you know, we were very good friends, and we had a lot of respect for Dr. Dolman. And we figured, well, he'd be able to figure this thing out. So, you know, the first thing he looked at, going, oh, you know, it's just a rock, and someone just glued this on there. And then he starts looking at it more and more, and going, oh, this is really, really interesting. And then he has this little, you know, little microscope that, or eyepiece, I should say, that all archaeologists have. You know, they look at things up real close. And he goes, whoa, this is way cool. When you get really in there and you start looking, the edges of the design coming out are in little lines. You know, almost, you know, sort of like what... Devil's Tower, you know, how you have the ridges on the side. So, you know, you've got this image coming out of the rock with, like, ridges like that. But, you know, you can only see that under a little microscope. And then what's really cool about the rock, it's not a lodestone. A magnet does not attract to it. It opposes it. And if you put a magnet on a rock, you can spin the rock, but the magnet doesn't stick to the rock. That's what a lodestone is. A magnet would stick to a lodestone. And since then, I've actually had two rocks made for me to use for comparison analysis, made out of lodestones, with a design very similar to, well, it's a, you know, I don't want to say it's exact because, you know, it's not exact, but it's the best that this particular gentleman could make for me. And he was featured on the Art Bell Show, or George Norrie. And I paid, I think, about $90 or $100 to have him make me a rock. Now, the debunker in this case, we had one person that said, oh, I threw that rock out there, you know, 2003 or whatever. I bought it for $3 at the UFO, you know, festival, and we, as a joke, we threw it out there. And what was unfortunate about that was one of the, not my website, but another website by a researcher had posted information on our rock, and without asking our permission. But that, you know, but it's okay, you know, because we're not making money off of this or anything. But it would have been kind of nice to talk to us first before that, you know, they went up to us and went to you know, to Robert, you know, our contact. But unfortunately, put all this information on their website, along with the location of where the rock was found, and you never, and if anybody's listening to me, you never, never, if the investigation is still ongoing, unless you close it, do not put the location of the investigation, because now what you've done, you salted the investigation. People can go to the area where the investigation is, you know, that you're still trying to research and work on, and do all kinds of crazy things. That's why we don't release the GPS coordinates for the debris site, because it's an ongoing investigation. So anyway, so anybody down there in that area of Lincoln County and Roswell would know where that area is and could say, oh, I threw the rock out there, and be very accurate to. Now, what they didn't know was when they talked to me over the phone and said, oh, yeah, we threw the rock out there from the little dirt road, and yes, they lived in the area, they knew there's a little dirt road out there. What they did know is you would really have to be a major league pitcher to be able to chuck that rock from the distance it was found from the road, or the little gravel road to where Robert Ridge is found it. You would really have to throw it, and they said they just tossed it off to the side, but you know, so someone could find it. You would really have to throw that son of a gun.
Yeah. Well, and the magnetic properties are really cool too.
Yeah, what's cool about
in relation to the shape of the design.
Yeah, absolutely. And matter of fact, you know, I've been doing a lot of talking lately. You know, let your audience, your listeners know that, I mean, you know, you were there. You got to play with the rock, and you got to see the magnetic properties of play with it. Go ahead and explain.
You were the guest. You're supposed to do all the talking. Right. Yeah, this design, though, has two circles on it. Really pretty design, like Chuck said, from a crop circle in the U.K., and when you put the magnet over one of the circles, it rotates one direction. But then when you put it over the other circle, it rotates in the opposite direction. And especially that property really baffles me.
Oh, absolutely. And the neat thing is you know, have your listeners, you know, visualize. You have this rock, and on one side of the rock, you have a crop circle.
Close your eyes, listeners.
Close your eyes. and you have a crop circle design on what we call the top side of the rock. If you turn the rock over, there's three little marks on the back side of the rock. Very interesting, almost triangular the way these there's two you can see, and one's kind of it's not really hard to see, but you have to look for it. But the magnetic properties on the back side or underneath the rock is totally different than the magnetic properties or the magnetic field from the top side where the crop circle design is. So it's almost as if the crop circle design itself, utilizing the minerals of the rock, create this magnetic property. And that's what's way cool about this. I have two more right here, you know, just right around the corner, right behind me. Matter of fact, that I had made for me out of lodestones. And the magnet will stick on both sides. It doesn't care. A lodestone's a lodestone. It's got a lot of iron in it, and it attracts a magnet. This, the Roswell Rock Circle, is very, very unique. It's you have different magnetic properties on one side and then on the other. And so one of the analyses we want to do on that is using fine metal shavings, and that's something that, you know, that you can buy. It's something in a lab. And what they can do is they can manipulate the metal shavings over and kind of put it over the top. And I'm not quite sure how they can do it, but basically the metal shavings will move around and kind of show us the magnetic field. If you picture the Earth, the magnetosphere of the Earth is kind of looks like two big ears. You know, if you look at the Earth from the outside, you know, let's say you're looking at it from Mars or whatever, and you look at the two big old ears on it, that's our magnetic field of the Earth, how it kind of loops around and kind of goes through the center of the Earth and through the North and South Pole, or, well, magnetic North and South. And so that's what we're looking for in a rock. We want to see what type of magnetic sphere or what type of magnetic tracing the rock has. And it's very unusual. Now, the archaeologist, Dr. Dolman, you know, he's been doing this 30-some years, and he's familiar with every type of rock out there, that at least in New Mexico desert, that he's seen. So this is baffling him, even so much so that he still talks about it and how he, you know, we're looking for funding also for that. If you come to the Roswell Festival this year in July, which is hosted by MUFON, and our good friend Alejandro was in charge of getting all the speakers together, which is, not an easy task. My sister and I are going to have a table there. We're giving a Roswell 101 workshop, and we're going to have a table there with some of the stuff that we do on it. But Robert Ridge, we talked to him last Friday, and he's going to be at our table with the Roswell Rock Circle, with 8x10 pictures and all kinds of nifty stuff. So anybody that shows up in Roswell this year, you know, go right over to the... Now, there's going to be like three separate lecturing, I guess, groups going on, but make sure you go to the MUFON one.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of the speakers coming up in that. But also on this one, it's a little hard to investigate this one for you because you live in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and... the rock is down there in Roswell, and, you know, wisely, this guy is holding on to the rock and not letting it out of his sight, which is probably a good idea, so, you know, it doesn't come up missing. Of course, you're a trustworthy fella, but that makes the research even a little more difficult, huh?
Absolutely. Robert knows us well enough now that he has told us that he would release the rock to me and my sister because he trusts us. And there's a big, and that's something else too for people out here that want to do investigations. The very first thing you've got to do when you're talking to a witness for the first time is you got to gain their trust first off. And it may be within the first 2 minutes of your conversation. First, you know, initial appearances, very, very, very important. You come across as a goofball, they won't want to give you a lot of information. As a matter of fact, they'll be, you know, giving you excuses to get away from you. And we've seen a lot of that.
Chuck tells them, hi, I'm the UFO nut, you're still able to build credibility.
Well, and that's the main thing. And yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes you'll get people going, well, you have UFO nut on your license plate. You know, and doesn't that lose credibility? I go, no, not really, because what that does is I'm honest right off the bat. You know, I'm a UFO investigator. I have fun with it, so much fun. I've been called a nut in the past that I put it on my license plate and put it on a website. If you come across honestly and up front, you'd be surprised at how much information you really get. That's what people want. People want honesty.
Yeah.
And what I
think is interesting with this is Robert's theory of what the rock is, too. He feels it's like some kind of key for a UFO, possibly, or kind of like a key to turn the UFO on.
You know, and that's really interesting, too, because, you know, everybody has a theory, and what investigators do is we try not to, and I can't speak for Alejandro, but I can only speak for me and my sisters. We attack everything very scientifically, and we try to eliminate anything that debunkers or skeptics could rip us apart about. And so we try not to theorize, you know, like, you know, with the piece of metal from Roswell. You're not going to hear me say, I have a piece of a UFO. No, I'll never say that until the lab says, hey, you got a piece of a UFO. Well, then that's science telling me. But right now... Oh, see, now Audrey just said something else to me. So you can't hear her, huh?
No, that voice, that's the blog talk. That's the system here.
Yeah, okay. So.
Oh, it is. It has an English voice that says blog talk radio.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
She tells me different things.
Does she tell you different things? I hope she doesn't talk about me behind my back, as far as I know. So basically, with the Roswell, you know, rock, you gain their trust, and when they realize how much effort, and we put a year's worth of effort in this before we went public last year on July, I think it was 5th or 6th, 6th, I think it was Sunday. We put a year's worth of research and investigation in this. And you just don't come right out with a press release saying, oh, I found something, here it is. You got to do some research first. And the research is there to make a statement, to show, you know, the listeners and the public that, you know, that you just don't throw this stuff out there without being a little realistic about it.
Yeah, but I think that's what's great with the witnesses or like Robert. They can speculate. And I think it's interesting to see what the regular Joe thinks about, you know, some of this anomalous stuff, which is just like the cattle mutilations that you went out and investigated, because Mike Duran, the rancher, it was fun to ask him, well, what do you think is going on here? And he says, well, I think UFOs are picking up these cattle and cutting them up and dropping them off.
Yeah, that's right.
And
You just sparked my mind real quick. Something I want to tell you. Go back to the Roswell Rock Circle. Here's something new. I don't think I told you this, but here's something new for your listeners. Woohoo! This is what you get for listening to Alejandro's show. remember when we were at the site where Robert found a piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
You remember we had Priscilla Wolf out there. For all your listeners out there, Priscilla Wolf is this neat Native American. I believe she's Apache. She's a storyteller. I think she's more of a shaman. Really, really neat lady, and I respect the heck out of her. So we brought her out there, took her out to the site. We wanted to make sure that before we did a press release, we would have at least a representative from the Native Americans to make sure that we weren't doing anything wrong that would be disrespectful to our Native American friends. So we had her out there. And she, remember when she went to the site, she started walking around?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I see that this rock was placed here. A beam of light came from the sky. And she circled around and she pointed to the area out of it. Were you there when she said that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, my sister Debbie in Missouri had met a lady who, and I apologize, I just forgot. What's it called when you have psychic investigators look at pictures? And
like a psychic, or you mean like a remote viewing or something?
Well, it's sort of like a remote viewing, but a lot of these psychics will help. I'm sure your listeners are yelling it out right now. You moron! It's, you know. Anyway, when you look at picture, mm-hmm. and they can take from a picture and kind of deduct what happened. Well, anyway, Debbie had met somebody out there that does that and actually has worked with the PD in the past. And she showed her a picture, an 8x10 picture of the rock. She goes, this was found over here by a sand bank. A beam of light came out of the sky, circling down, and placed it there. And she's going, huh? And so we've got a written report on that. And so this is just another step. Now, it's not anything that I would say actually happened, because I'm trying to be very scientific about this. But like Alejandro was saying, you know, you have to listen to the other perspectives of people and what they think. So now when you listen to the other perspectives and the other ideas and theories from the people, now if you get four or five different people in different parts of the U.S. that are giving you somewhat of the same information, you take that same information, you start working on that too, because that's commonality. And is it coincidence that here you have two separate ladies in two different parts of the U.S. that saw the same thing?
Well, you know, that sparks just a separate question real quick. Just since you also are a reserve police officer out in Colorado Springs, right?
Yeah.
Have they ever used psychics out there?
Well,
have
you
ever been involved or known of a case?
Yeah, well, I'm a reserve deputy for the county, and I have to throw this in every time anybody says I don't represent the sheriff's department in any way, form, when
mm-hmm.
doing a UFO investigation, I don't represent a UFO investigators. It just happens to be something else that I do with. And yes, you learn from both, and you can use things that you learn from both ends to help out with both. But that's a whole other story, and I'll have to explain that to you later. But I always have to put that little thing in now anytime anybody mentions that I'm a reserve. So what was your question?
Do you know of any, have you been involved with any cases where a psychic was used?
No, not really. No, not really. I know they would be very open. At least the people that I've talked to, even, you know, for the county and for the city, are very open to it. And what's interesting is when they find out that I am a UFO investigator, you'd be surprised, you know, what information I do get, and they start telling me about their personal experiences. I did learn one thing that was kind of interesting, that all the police departments, the county, state, and city, back in the 90s, late 90s, when we had that run of cattle mutilations, actually ventured out to the San Luis Valley for a cattle mutilation class.
Wow.
Way cool. And I actually met someone in the department that went there. And it basically,
wow.
it was a quick class and a briefing on what's going on, because we had so many cattle mutilations. Now, for your listeners out there, you know, the very first mutilation that made the papers, really, that got a lot of press, and there were some before that, was, you know, back in, what, I think it was 67, and that was, they call it Snippy the Horse, but I think his name was really Lady. And that happened in the San Luis Valley. We're starting to see reports before that, but that was the one that got the most press. Now,
mm-hmm.
what's interesting is since the late 60s, nobody's been caught. And we've had rashes of cattle mutilations and horse and all kinds of stuff, not only in Colorado, but all across the U.S. And nobody has been caught and put to trial or sent to jail or fined or anything.
What were some of the speculation, or was there any that they were taught in that training that they went to?
Well, basically, from what information I got, and I didn't get a lot of it, was, you know, what's the first signs of something that would put a mutilation case in that particular type of category? And what it was
mm-hmm.
was, you know, obvious, you know, scavenger. Or not, I shouldn't say scavenger, predator, you know, or scavenger, and then evidence of a predator scavenger. It's basic stuff like that. And then, of course, you know, they would talk about what local groups could do it. You know, everybody always points to, you know, the pagans or Wiccans. I mean, really, seriously, you know, If it's going to be a local group, it's going to be a local group of college people that are out there having beers and want to do it for some stupid reason. But I haven't seen anything that was any type of a witch ritual or warlock ritual where they had to do that, at least in the research and investigations that I've done. But basically, that's all briefed. You know, everything is open, everything's put on the table, and you kind of talk about it all. I can't tell you exactly what they talked about, because I didn't get a lot of information. The only information I got was the fact that they did do it. And
that's
there was
pretty
so
cool
much,
about stuff.
Yeah, and there was so much of a concern that representatives from all over the state were sent down there. You know.
Mm-hmm. So, recently... Uh-huh.
No, go
I was
ahead.
Going to say recently, and these are mutilations that you investigated. The authorities that you worked with took this all very seriously.
Oh, absolutely. The very first one, the Duran case, the local sheriff's department down there, Well, actually, in all three cases that I worked on last month, Duran, Miller, and Guerin, there were criminal reports, really, for each one of them. So there was case reports for all three. And
wow.
And really, you know, law enforcement takes it very, very seriously when someone kills an animal is killed. And if it doesn't look obvious, you know, hit by a car, hit by lightning, or, you know, or predator damage or predator kill, it becomes an unknown kill, which means it could be a criminal act. And so if it looks like it could possibly be a criminal act, then a case report would be pulled on it or filed or whoever, you know, however they do it. And then there's some type of an investigation. Now, I had talked to the deputy down there in the Duran area, and they actually filed and opened a case on it. And I gave him my analysis at the very end, along with the results from Colorado State University, to help him finish his case, and so he can close the case off. But you know, when you have an animal, well, the Duran case, the animal was kind of, you know, was what, 26 or 27 years old. It was one of his oldest cows. It was his favorite cow because it's been around for as long as he was there, you know, ranching, and so he took care of it a little separately. And it kind of broke his heart when he found it dead, thinking, well, it died of natural causes. But it had calves, what, just a couple months before, I think. So it still had a fairly new calf. Now, with the Guerin case, that animal was 2.5 years old.
And that's the second case?
No, that would be the third case. I'm skipping the second case just for a quick second to just show the third case, the Guerin cow, close to 1,100 pounds, a couple years old, just calved. A cow like that would probably sell, you know, $1,600, $1,700, depending on the breed, too.
Wow.
You know, how much money. The Duran one, the very first one, because it was so old, you know, they wouldn't, you know, there wouldn't be a lot of money involved in you know, selling that animal, but it was still calving. And if a calf, you know, you put money into the animal when they're pregnant, you invest more money and you give it special vitamins and feed, you know, to make sure the animal's healthy so that, you know, the calf is healthy. So you put, you know, there's more expenses into it. Now, that's what I was expecting, you know, with all three mutilated. And then the second one, I apologize, is the Miller, and it was a calf. And the calf was roughly 5 days old. So really, at that age, the calf is probably worth $150, $200, maybe $300 at the most, depending on the breed it was. So, you know, they're worth more as they get older, obviously.
Yeah. Well, and maybe real quick for any listeners who aren't familiar with cattle mutilations, kind of some of the general properties or characteristics of that sort of phenomena, if you could overview that for us.
Yeah, well, the main thing for any type of animal death, mutilation, the very first thing you look for any type of animal death is an obvious reason for death. That's the very first thing. And that has to do with any, obviously, a homicide. You know, what's the reason that the animal died? And then you look at what happened to the animal, you know, and the udder is missing or cored out, or the vaginal area is cored out, or the tongue is missing, or an eye is missing, or the whole side of the face looks like it's been laser etched off. You know, those are obvious. You know, you look at it going, oh my gosh, you know, that doesn't look like a natural way to die. And so basically the first thing that's a red flag is, you know, does it look like a natural death? And then the second thing you look at is, okay, what happened to the animal, you know, that's unusual? And that's, of course, that's the coring out. And then the third thing you do is you try to look for any type of evidence. Now, you have to understand the difference between how a cow is brought down by Mother Nature. I mean, obviously, it's internal. The cow could have something internally wrong with it and just die. And but there should be blood. And a lot of times, after you see the scavenger damage, if there's no blood around, that's another key, too. There should be blood all over the place if it's a natural death, because they bleed out, especially after the scavenger takes it.
You know, one new thing I learned, too, which I didn't know about, And I had heard, and my friend had gone to a cattumulation. She's like, it's covered with all this white stuff. Well, later we found out that was magpie droppings, because magpies attack these things, and they while they're eating them, they just kind of, they're so barbaric that they just let themselves go and defecate all over the animal. So, and that was one thing the ranchers had pointed out, like Mike Moran, about how there was no magpie. First of all, it didn't look like magpies weren't around it. They hadn't seen any. They weren't attacking it like usual. And it wasn't full of their excrement.
Oh, absolutely. And that was another case for another way of looking at it, naturally, too, is what type of scavenger damage does it have? You know, birds mm-hmm. are the first thing to get to its scavengers. And if a scavenger doesn't touch an animal like that for a while, and they're in the area, you know, they couldn't just not be in the area, but if they're in the area and they don't touch it, that's another red flag, because usually they're
that's
all over.
That's weird.
Now, predator and scavenger, you got to remember the big difference between a predator and a scavenger is a predator is an animal that will take down another animal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that a predator will actually be responsible for a kill. A scavenger
right.
is basically comes over and cleans up afterwards. So, in let's say the Guerin case, the last case, this is a particular cow that calved Friday night. They found the cow 2:30 in the afternoon on Saturday. The newborn calf was 50, 45 yards away, still alive, laying where it was born, waiting for the mom to come back. The mom was dead, lying on its side. Number one red flag. Mom never leaves a calf after a newborn, because what happens is they stay with the calf it's you know nurses, and it's not milk at that point, it's colostrum, whatever it's called, and it's a you know it's a combination of nutrients and vitamins, and that's how the calf will survive for the next couple of days. Milk doesn't come in for till a few days later, so the cow stays with the calf. They don't split them up. Matter of fact, ranchers, if they try to ever give vitamins to a calf, they have to go through the cow first. So they have to figure out some way of getting around the cow to get the calf to make sure the calf is healthy. So one number one red flag, mom's too far away from the baby. Second red flag is mom's laying on its side. The udder's missing. The udder, just the whole udder's missing. Big old hole there where the udder used to be. The sac was probably full of the vitamins and nutrients for the calf. The calf, we did find out the calf did nurse a little bit before mama walked away somehow or ventured away. Third red flag, no predator damage. And one of the things that we do when we go to these cattle mutilations, you know, and safety first, you put on your mask, and if they're out there for a few days, they're ripe, and Alejandro knows that for sure. He's experienced that.
Yeah.
So since then, Alejandro, I've got a respirator now that's
catching
bacteria.
Yeah, great idea.
Yeah, so it's a full respirator now that I have, and then surgical gloves. So, you know, they don't cut easy. And the first thing you do is you look at the animal, and you start running your hands up and down the animal looking for predator damage, bite marks, claw marks, anything that would cause the animal to go down. Then you start looking around, is there any reason why this animal just decided just to fall over right there, you know, and you look for, you know, well, you know, by the time we get there, in the last two cattle mutilations, I was there within 36 hours, so, you know, there was some scavenger damage, actually, on the third one, not the second one, so you can see scavenger marks there, but you can clearly see, oh, here's something pretty cool about the Guerin case that I should have put in the report. The scavengers came in Saturday night. I got the report late Saturday afternoon, early Saturday night, and I was there early Saturday morning. Sunday morning. So sometime within Saturday night, some coyotes came in and went in through the anal area. The reason why here's something that I learned too. Coyotes have a tendency of going in toward the soft tissue is, and that's in the anal area. Predators, you know, if you guys watch, you know, Animal Planet, all your big predators, your cats and stuff, mountain lions, bobcats, whatever, they go for the gut. They go for the center, and that's where they go. They don't go for the – so we have an idea that there were coyotes that came in. They never touched the udder area. All the damage was in the vaginal area. Although the udder was missing, there was open flesh. And there was another thing, too. Just the udder was missing. Nothing was cut in past where the, you know, into the animal itself, into the casing of the animal or into the muscle tissue. All that was there. It was as if someone took a razor blade and just cut off the udder. Now, the anal area was eaten by your scavengers, and there was plenty of evidence on the ground there, which you would expect to find. And as an investigator, you go, that's
blood and
da-da-da-da-da-da. There was no scavenger evidence where the udder was missing. There was no blood. There was no anything there. And to tear that
out, and I think it, to put into perspective, especially like the Duran animal where there was no scavenger damage at all, that's like taking a birthday cake and putting it in your office break room and nobody touching it.
And nobody touches it.
That would be weird.
And that's a great analogy.
You know, people are on that in a heartbeat. Well, actually, we got to start wrapping up here. And we only got a minute or so left. But we didn't get a whole lot into the cattle mutilation. Chuck's going to talk about that more. So for those of you here in Denver, you're going to hear more about that tomorrow. Otherwise, we'll bring Chuck on again so he can talk about that. Also, remember, you can go to examiner.com, and you've probably already done this because I've been talking about it, and go to the Denver Paranormal Science Examiner. That's me, and I put some articles up about this. But, of course, Chuck has some great insights and personal experience that he'll be able to share with us tomorrow. And if you're out of state, like I know many of you are, because I know many of you download this on your podcast, we'll have Chuck on again later. And now, Chuck, what is your regular daytime job?
I design microchips. I'm an IC mass design engineer. Been doing that about 22 years now.
Yeah, and that's what I think is impressive. An on-the-go guy designing microchips, reserve deputy, and still able to get out and get your hands dirty and get elbow deep into a cattle mutilation.
I get elbow deep in a lot of things.
All right.
Well,
we'll
you
see you
very
in
much
the
for having me on.
Chuck. Yep, UFONut.com. He talked about. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We definitely will have a show next weekend. I know we didn't the last couple. Partially because of finals. I'm taking 5 classes and full-time work, and that has been very difficult. But the semester's over, and so is the Sci-Fi Conference, and so soon will be the Colorado UFO Briefing, and we'll be back on track. So we'll talk to you guys in a couple weeks. Thanks again, Chuck.
Thank you.
And we have our cool closed music that was provided by Systematics. You can see his link on the front of my blog top.
Appreciate the down.